Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and delighted to have you here with us. As we celebrate the Christmas season, it's a great time to meditate on, well, Christmas. And we find out most of what we know about the first Christmas from the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. And here to help us discuss what we find there in the Scripture is our resident Scripture scholar, I guess among several here, but Jimmy knows his Bible, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of the brand new book, Teaching with Authority. Hi, Jimmy.
Merry Christmas, Cy.
Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Is this going to be airing in Christmas? Because if it's not, then the Advent people will be, oh, it's technically Advent.
I don't believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
No, here's the deal. Because when you say Merry Christmas, it could be forward looking.
Mm-hmm,
like,
sure,
like you
proleptic.
Like have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah,
you know, like that's
well, and it's almost unavoidable to say things like that when you're talking to people who you're not going to see until Christmas.
Right.
In the season leading up to it.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
It's like let's say I'm out at a social club, you know, let's say English Country Dance Club.
Right.
And I'm not going to see people beforehand. Well, you wish them a Merry Christmas ahead of time.
Yeah, that's what I do at my International Spycraft Club,
mm-hmm.
where people
– And you really have to be careful because if you don't – if you tick off the spies
– Oh, those people will.
They can like totally poison you.
You're doomed. All right. Christmas in the Bible. Okay, before we get to the Gospels, I'm going to share this with you. It seems like some of the stuff that we know about Christmas or that we read at Christmas and all that, it actually doesn't come in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in the Old Testament.
Okay.
A good deal of it from Isaiah and whatnot.
Yep.
And then I think some from...
Yeah, they have a word for that, right?
What's that called?
Prophecy.
Ah, yes. All right. So prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you the question this way. Did Matthew and Luke, as they wrote their Gospels, evidence in the way they wrote about the...
Christmas event?
The Christmas event, yeah. A dialoguing with referring to that prophecy. Do we get any of that in the?
Oh yeah, I mean, in both cases, we have an allusion to how Christmas is the fulfillment of various Old Testament prophecies.
Okay.
Matthew, in particular, is known for calling out and identifying Old Testament prophecies as being fulfilled in Jesus's life. And so, in this respect, you know, one of the ones that gets cited is from Isaiah about. The virgin or young woman, depending on your translation, will conceive and bear a son, and you will call his name Emmanuel. And so that's a prophecy from early on in the book of Isaiah, and it has a Christological reference.
So and then there are things as well. Each of these has a genealogy, which I find interesting. That Mark and John don't give us a genealogy, mm-hmm. but Matthew and Luke both do.
Yep.
Each from earthly parents.
No.
No?
No, they're both genealogies of Joseph. You sometimes hear the idea, because people are aware that they're different genealogies.
Right.
They don't trace exactly the same line. And so people kind of think, well, how do we reconcile that? Well, he had two parents. I bet
one's Mary, Mary's
one's Joseph. Not actually. You read them, they're both genealogies of Joseph.
Okay, so let's say Matthew's, I believe, goes back to Abraham. Is that right? And then Luke goes back to
Adam.
And why not before Adam? Just kidding.
Well, in the 19th century, there could be people who would ask that question.
Because?
There were people in the 19th century who would speculate about pre-Adamic races. And there's even a line in the Mikado where the high official Poobah, which is where we get the word Poobah, is very.
I thought it was from the Flintstones.
No, it's from the they got it from the Mikado, and Poobah is extremely proud of all kinds of things, including his heritage. And one of the things he is very proud of is the fact he can trace his ancestry back to a protoplasmal primordial atomic globule.
Well, all the high society can do that. Okay, so let's take the genealogy back to Abraham.
Okay.
A couple things that hit my mind with that genealogy.
Lay it on me.
One is the division into 14 generations.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
So one of the things that you discover when you study biblical genealogies is that they can skip and omit generations.
Okay.
It's not like you have to list every generation going back to a certain point.
Okay.
One of the reasons for that is probably the fact that they didn't have words in Hebrew or Aramaic for son or grandson or great-grandson. They just had father and son.
Yeah.
So any male you're descended from is your father. Any son, any right. male descendant of yours is your son, no matter how many generations removed.
Right.
And so that's one way that Jesus can be described, for example, as the son of David.
Yes,
even
right.
though David lived 1,000 years earlier.
I mean, right.
He's
called in that one son of Abraham and David, right?
And so you could skip genealogies. And so for a reason— Matthew chose to structure his genealogy, which begins with Abraham and ends with Jesus, in three groups of 14. And at the kind of crux points, if you've got three groups, there are two points where the three groups touch each other. So like there's the first block and it ends, and then there's this crux point. And then you've got the second block and it ends and there's a crux point. And then there's a third one and the final crux point is the Messiah. The first crux point connecting the first block to the second block is David. And the second is the Babylonian exile. So these Abraham, David, Babylonian exile, Christ, these are four major events in salvation history. And Matthew chooses to structure them in terms of sets of 14 generations.
Yeah.
The question is, why 14? Why not 15? Why not 13? Why not 12? 12 is a big biblical number.
Yeah, right. Actually, that's the one I would pick.
Uh-huh.
12, yeah.
Well, so it so happens. Now, you know how in Revelation the number of the beast is 666?
Yes.
And the idea is because in ancient scripts like Greek and Aramaic and Hebrew, they didn't have a separate set of numbers. I mean, in English, we have the alphabet A to Z, and then we have the Arabic numerals from 0 to 9, and we make all the numbers out of those. Well, they didn't have those. Arabic numerals hadn't been invented yet. They're a much later development. And so consequently, they used the letters of the alphabet to double for their number system.
Okay.
So each letter of the alphabet has a number.
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
And if you add up the numbers in a word or a name, you come up with a number, an overall number. And so the idea in Revelation, you add up the numbers of the beast, whatever his real name is as a human. Spoiler, it's Nero Caesar. And it's going to add up to 666.
Well, I didn't get to the end yet.
Yeah. Well,
I really should have. Okay.
So,
I'll have to finish that Bible one of these days.
So guess whose number adds up to 14?
Is it Jesus?
No.
Oh.
In Jesus' name adds up in Greek to 888.
Wow.
Yeah. How about that?
Wow.
But in Hebrew and Aramaic, the letter D, Daleth, is 4.
Okay.
The letter Wow or Vav, the equivalent of V, is 6. And then, of course, as we mentioned, the letter D or Daleth is 4.
So David.
David. Yeah. So that's the coded message in the numbering of Jesus's Messiah in Matthew. David, David, David. He's the son of David.
I feel like we could do a special on the History Channel, the secret code of the the Davidic code. Okay, so David, because he's David the king. That's what he's called
right.
in there.
He's the archetypical king of Israel.
Right, and that strikes me that some people get a title. Jesus is who is called the Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That's the title he gets. But some of the titles are associated with women, like Joseph.
Yeah. I was going to make a different point. What were you saying?
I was going to say Joseph, the husband of Mary, and I can't remember who is the husband of Ruth or Tamara, I think, is the other woman.
So we are making essentially the same point.
Okay.
What's also really unusual about this genealogy is it has women in it.
Yeah.
This is not normal for a biblical genealogy. They were a patriarchal culture, and so the genealogies were tracing the male lineage and really didn't mention women.
Yeah.
This is very unusual. But in this case, we do in fact have four women who are mentioned.
Okay, I missed somebody.
The first one to get mentioned is Rahab the harlot. or Rahab,
yeah.
who let the spies, she helped shelter the spies at the time of Joshua.
Okay.
And thus helped the Israelites. The second is Ruth, who was married to Boaz, and she was a Moabitess, right. And she, whereas Rahab or Rahab was a Canaanite. And
okay.
Then Ruth is a Moabitess. She's from Moab, but yeah. she adopts herself into Israelite culture and ends up marrying Boaz, the grandfather of David. So this is David's grandmother.
Right.
The next one is the wife of Uriah the Hittite, and she's not named.
We know
but
who she is.
We know who she is. It's Bathsheba.
Right.
And so so she's Solomon's mother. She's one of David's wives after David encompasses the death of Uriah the Hittite, and to use a fancy term for it, he arranged to have him
everybody step back.
Yeah. yeah. And so those are and then Mary is the last one. So those are the four. It's Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba and Mary.
Okay. And
so it makes you wonder why they're there, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. It seems like there's some reason why we're mentioning these women.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's two possibilities.
Okay.
The first one, now, Matthew, even though it's the most Jewish of all the Gospels, it's clearly written for an audience of Jewish Christians.
Okay.
Even though it's the most Jewish of all the Gospels, it still has a prominent interest in Gentiles. So you notice when Jesus is born, who is it that visits? It's Gentiles who come to worship him.
Yeah.
And then Jesus has various interactions and things to say about Gentiles during the Gospel. And what's the climax? The Great Commission.
Go make disciples,
of all the nations.
Oh.
And the word in Greek is ethnoi, which is the word for Gentiles.
Oh.
Go make disciples of all the Gentiles. That's the climax of the Gospel.
I never heard that was what that meant.
I know you don't hear it, but that's what I mean. It also includes Jews in this usage, but to a first century Jewish reader, go make disciples of all the ethnoi.
Wow.
That's all the ethnic groups, all the Gentiles.
Yeah.
So one thing that has been pointed out, Rahab, she's a Canaanite.
Right.
She's not an Israelite.
Yep.
Ruth, she's a Moabite.
Yep.
She's not a Canaanite. Bathsheba is the wife of Uriah the Hittite.
Yeah.
He's a Hittite. That's a civilization from over in Turkey. There's one of the major ancient powers in the region. So presumably she's another Hittite.
Yeah.
And all of these women are Gentiles. That may be part of why Matthew chose to include them.
He's pointing out that the Gentiles have joined us before.
Can have a role in the line of the Messiah.
Fair enough.
But that only explains three of the four.
Yeah,
we've also got Mary. Mary's not a Gentile.
No.
Not at all. So is there something else that could link these women? Well, so Rahab was righteous because she helped the Israelites.
Oh, yeah.
But she was a prostitute.
Okay.
And so that means she was a sinner too, who then became righteous.
Okay.
Ruth was a pagan idolater before she came to worship the God of Israel.
Okay.
And Bathsheba was an adulteress who, from what we're given to understand, seems to have deliberately seduced King David. Because she's bathing in the nude on her rooftop with inside the palace.
Right. Morning, David.
Yeah. So she has a reputation as being a sinner too, even though she goes on to have a very prominent place in Israelite history, being the mother of Solomon, the king who built the temple.
Yep.
So we have this pattern of these women who have shady reputations, even though they're clearly part of the line of David and of the eventual Messiah. Well, is there anything about Mary's reputation in the first century?
Oh, yeah, because she had a child
before she and Joseph started to cohabit. So the presumption would have been that Mary had been sleeping around.
Right.
And so she would have had a negative reputation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so by saying, wait a minute, don't dismiss women in connection with the Messiah just because they have a reputation.
So this
reputation.
Is overcoming an objection.
Exactly.
Like this, yeah. We've been through this before.
Yeah.
These even sinful women.
Still had a role in the Messiah's.
Right. Even David's grandmother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And, all right. Well, so let's talk about Luke then.
Okay.
I think that's everything I want. Yeah. Okay. So Luke goes back to Abraham. I mean, excuse me. Luke goes back to Adam.
Yeah. His is interesting because it's in reverse chronological order. It's like a blog. So he starts with Jesus and then goes all the way back to Adam.
That's why we get the word beget in there a lot. Is that the one with begets or no?
No. Beget is an action done by the Father, and that's in Matthew's.
Oh, that's
in Matthew. Luke, it's was the son of.
Was the son of. Okay, right. All right. So, and why? Do you have any, is there any reason why?
Well, I mean, you can run a genealogy either forwards or backwards. Normally they're forwards,
okay.
But Luke does it backwards. And ultimately it's because, I think, because of the way he ends it, because he doesn't just say the son of Adam, the end. He says the son of Adam, the son of God. So he's portraying Adam as the son of God. And it would be weird kind of to start a genealogy by saying, this is the genealogy of Jesus. There was Adam, the son of God, and then there was Seth, and there's this other guy.
It's kind of a come down with everybody else.
Yeah. And so by doing it in reverse order, he knows he's communicating, he's already done it in chapter one, that Jesus is going to be called the son of the Most High or the son of God.
Yeah.
And so he's already introduced Jesus as the son of God. And then he, at Jesus' baptism, he does the genealogy. He says, Jesus, the son of Joseph, blah, 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 working all the way back to Adam, the son of God. So he's deliberately setting up a parallelism between Jesus and Adam, which is a parallelism that's explored, for example, in St. Paul's writings.
Right.
About Jesus is the new Adam or the second Adam, and he undoes the work of the first Adam. So Luke's already playing with that similar idea here in his gospel. It's not something unique to Paul, although Luke quite likely got it from Paul. But he, as a literary thing, it serves as a nice capstone to his genealogy, as a dramatic finish to say, Adam, the son of God.
Yeah. Now, is it also of any interest or is it connected to the Jewishness of Matthew and the Greekness of Luke that one goes back to Abraham and one goes back to Adam?
To a certain point, yes. I mean, Gentiles wouldn't have known who Adam was unless they had already had contact with Jewish culture. But by going back beyond Abraham, Luke also indicates that there's a more universal aspect because Abraham was in a way considered the founding patriarch of Israel, even though it was really his grandson Jacob who became the patriarch Israel.
Yeah.
And Jacob's name gets changed to Israel.
Right.
But really they looked to Abraham as kind of the founder of our group. And so by going back and stressing Jesus's descent from these other people, it gives it a more universal scope because if you do know who Adam is, he's the father of us all. And so it relates Jesus not just to everyone in the line of Abraham, but everyone in the human race.
Anything else of note from Luke's genealogy before we move on?
Yeah.
Okay, what's
it's
that?
Also got a hidden structure.
Okay, the Bible code revealed.
So Luke's hidden structure seems to be based on the number 7.
Okay.
Which is the number of days in a week, and it seems to be based around 11 groups of 7 with some generations collapsed in, but that seems to be the guiding template. And this is explored in a fascinating book. It's a commentary on Jude and the Relatives of Jesus by the British scholar Richard Baucom. And it's related to some similar you know how Matthew has this salvation history framework.
Yeah.
Okay, the different major events in salvation history.
Right.
Well, there was another that also represented the history of salvation in terms of these units of 7. And as if salvation history is built of a series of kind of salvific history weeks. And it looks like that's playing a role in Luke's genealogy. So check out Baucom's Jude and the Relatives of Jesus for that.
Okay.
But then there's also one other thing.
What's that?
Why do they take different lines?
Oh, okay. Yes. Thank you. Of course I should have asked that. Yeah. Why?
So one question that people have is, well, does that mean they contradict each other? And the answer is no, because none of us have just one line of genealogy.
Yeah.
We have multiple lines because we have multiple ancestors.
Yeah.
And if you go back far enough, you're going to find some ancestor who you're descended from in multiple different ways.
Right.
You know, because people lived in the same village in history.
Right.
They didn't travel, so they'd intermarry. And so so as a result, you'll have multiple lines of your own ancestry converging on the same person in the past.
Uh-huh.
And this has been well studied in the case of nobility, for example. So they've actually calculated, like, so how is Queen Elizabeth II descended from, say, William the Conqueror?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like over 100 ways.
Yeah,
you know,
that would make sense.
Because William the Conqueror had royal offspring. They married other nobility and it just a bunch of swapping.
So you can get from Elizabeth to William
multiple different
take
ways.
Take this path, take that path. Yeah.
So when you have David as the famous ancestor of Jesus, well, given the smallness of the nation of Israel.
And a thousand years. Yeah.
There's going to be – I mean, that's basically the distance between Elizabeth and William the Conqueror.
Yeah.
A little bit more, actually. And so there's going to be loads of ways that Jesus descends from David.
Right.
The question is, why do they pick different ones?
Yeah.
Well, one thing we know is that now these genealogies both had to come from family tradition.
Mm-hmm.
We know Luke in particular had contact with Jesus's family or people who knew Jesus's family at a minimum, because that's where he gets the information for his infancy narrative. So Jesus's family clearly preserved this, but they also had to preserve this other one. Why would they have two genealogies preserved? I mean, when you only need one to prove you got this famous lineage.
Different branches of the family.
Well, possibly, but there's also something else. There's the prophecy. There's that word again.
Okay.
Of the shoot of David. And
so
what happened was, you know, God promised David an everlasting dynasty if his sons obeyed him and obeyed God. And they did for a while, but then they didn't. And God eventually said, okay, no descendant of this guy, Jeconiah, is going to sit on the throne. Well, that could look like, if that prophecy doesn't get rescinded,
mm-hmm.
it could look like there's not going to be any more Davidic monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have this prophecy about out of the stump of Jesse, there will come a shoot that mm-hmm. is the Messiah. And scholars have looked at that and said, okay, if Jesse is at this point, Jesse is David's father. And so if the line of Jesse has become a stump
mm-hmm.
because God has cut off this line with Jeconiah, then how would you get a new Davidic monarch? Well, you might get a shoot growing out of the stump from the side,
mm-hmm.
and it would be like a different line coming from the family of Jesse and David, but not the one that Jeconiah came from. Jeconiah came from the line of Solomon. So David's son Solomon gave the monarchical line that Jeconiah then terminates.
Right.
Now, there is, though, a debate about did God rescind the prophecy against Jeconiah, and the evidence is mixed.
Okay.
So you could look at it and say, no, God rescinded the condemnation on Jeconiah. He repented and so forth. And so there's no problem with having the Messiah be a son of Jeconiah and thus a son of Solomon.
Right.
But other people could look at it and say, I don't know if he did. Maybe the Messiah needs to be a descendant of David, but not through Solomon.
Yeah.
Maybe through another son like Nathan, the one that Luke cites in his genealogy.
Yeah.
And so the two complementary genealogies through the line of Nathan and through the line of Solomon may be there because there was a mixed opinion about would the Messiah come from the line of Solomon or not.
Yeah.
And either way, the evangelists are telling us Jesus is covered because he's descended from both lines.
Ah, wow. So I'm going to just make a supposition here that Paul was – that the Apostle Paul was mm-hmm. probably of the opinion that the Messiah would not come from the Solomon – in line, because that's where Luke ended up,
and
he would have been taught by that.
It's possible, yeah.
All right, fair enough.
Whereas Matthew is much more royal in his outlook than Luke,
yeah,
and would be more inclined perhaps to see Solomon as the decisive figure.
Fair enough. All right, so much, and we're only through the genealogies. So we will continue this next week on Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks so much for being here with us this time. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And we continue with our discussion of the Nativity in the Bible with Jimmy next week on Catholic Answers Focus.